Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 568. We are here today to preview the 2015 Stanley Cup Finals. It is I, Rick Morris, FDH Lounge dignitary, along with another one of our great FDH Lounge dignitaries, longtime contributor and friend Steve Callis. You can also catch him with his regular podcast on the STN.net. He is known for popping up as well on WFAN in New York, as well at WFAN.com and SteveCallis.com. That's K-A-L-L-A-S, where you can find a lot of his great writings. Of course, he is somebody who has a long-time interest and expertise in a number of sports, and hockey, of course, being one of them. And in his sports journalism career, I believe we have talked hockey with him previously. Today, we're going to be breaking down the Cup. And one thing that both of us have in common is that the road to the Eastern Conference Finals, Tampa Bay carved a swath through both of our favorite teams. First of all, my Detroit Red Wings, subsequently then Montreal, and then in the conference finals, the New York Rangers. I do have to say, I have to put this out there, I feel obliged to put this out there, that out of the 14 playoff series thus far, for anybody who's been following them on the FDH Lounge multimedia magazine, the FDHLounge.blogspot.com, with my picks before every round, I have been 13-1 to this point. I got Montreal and Ottawa wrong in the first round. I did have Tampa Bay from there beating Ottawa in the second round, of course. But aside from that, have gotten them all right, which is, as Steve put to me the other night off air, why am I not rich? And indeed, I have no answer for that. I should have got down on it. I didn't, and it will be my everlasting regret that I did not. So I have nothing to show financially for it, Steve, but I do have the chance for an excellent conversation with you today, which I'm sure will be compensation enough.
Well, I don't know if it's compensation enough, Rick. Good to be with you, but it's priceless, I guess. It's priceless. It's not going to pay your rent, but 13-1, that's stunning. You know, I can't remotely match that. I did like Chicago to win the Cup before the season. I did like Chicago to pick to win the Cup before the playoffs as well. But frankly, I thought Anaheim outplayed them, but when it came down to Game 7, of course, the class, the two Stanley Cups in the last, you know, five seasons, that came through on the road as Chicago did win Game 7. So, yeah, you're on a roll. Buy some lotto tickets, or hopefully someone with some cash was following you, saw your picks at the FDH Lounge, and, you know, got down, because that's a stunning record.
I truly wish I'd had the foresight to do so myself, but, you know, it was a thing where, obviously, again, I did have Chicago coming out of the Western Conference before it started. And before we take a look at the finals here, let's take a look at the path to the finals out of either conference, and we'll start right there with the West, since we've been talking about it a little bit. Ultimately, with Anaheim, they were going up against, as you said, that championship pedigree that the Blackhawks have. And then also, going into this postseason, what had been a sort of checkered playoff career for Coach Bruce Boudreau. And additionally, Anaheim, since they won the Cup in 07, the reputation of a couple of their stars, particularly the big ones, Getzlaff and Perry, has taken a little bit of a pounding. So, is it a lot more complicated than the narrative would indicate, which is simply just that Chicago right now seems like a team of closers and Anaheim doesn't?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, they always say the fourth win is the hardest one to get, and I'll say it again, in my opinion, and again, I was hoping the Blackhawks would not only win that series, but win the Cup. I thought the Blackhawks were outplayed in five of the six prior games, but they gutted it out, they won in overtime. I kind of like Bruce Boudreau since I saw him on that HBO series they had, and he's really, you know, speaks his mind and is a loud mouth. I thought it was good for him to get away from the Capitals. The Capitals, as you know, are still, I think Ovechkin's the best player in hockey. He clearly was better than Crosby this year, but they could never get over the hump. Was it Boudreau's fault? Was it the Capitals' fault? Well, the Capitals kind of folded again this year. Holtby played great against the Rangers. They still couldn't beat the Rangers. But now you transfer Boudreau and his baggage, if you will, over to Anaheim, and I think you're right. I think Anaheim just had trouble getting by a seasoned team of champions with superstars. You know, in the NBA, they always talk about how the superstars win. Well, I think it's often the same in the NHL, and you know the list they have, Kane and Taze, and, you know, I mean, they're just unbelievable. Without the strongest goaltender on earth, we'll talk about Corey Crawford, I'm sure, during this session, but I think at the end of the day, it was Stanley Cup experience, win in 2010, win in 2013, coupled with stars. Hossa, I should throw in there as well, an experienced star, that was just too much for Anaheim. But I'll say it again, Rick, I thought Anaheim outplayed them the first six games of this series.
I thought that they did too. However, a follow-up that I have on that was my sense when Chicago won not one but two of not just the overtime games, the sort of uber overtime games, my sense, especially when they did it a second time, is, you know what, they're going to win the series. I don't know if it's just anecdotal, but doesn't it seem like a team that wins one game like that in a series, much less two, generally is the one that comes out the winner, whether it's because they're not kicking themselves as much for letting something get away? Is that just my imagination, or does that tend to happen more often than not?
No, I think that's true. It's probably an Elias Sports Bureau question. But generally speaking, and you can imagine in the locker room, and I'm sure you've read about it or even maybe had some experiences in your life in those kinds of games in hockey or other sports, but those are devastating defeats and glorious victories. And I believe that they can linger on to the next game. And I think that that has happened and does happen and did happen in the Blackhawks-Ducks series.
Absolutely. And one of my all-time favorite hockey games, of course, was from the 0-2 finals, the one that went to, I think it was triple overtime. Larionov got the game winner, and I think that just pretty much sucked the life out of the Hurricanes the rest of the way through. It's very, very tough for teams to come back from something like that. Conversely, in the Eastern Conference, I don't know if there was really any kind of semblance of continuity in that final series, any kind of sense of carryover from one game to the next, especially as the series wore on. And if anything, that's something I think that your team, the Rangers, and my team, the Red Wings, had in common, because there would be games where you would be despondent after letting one get away. Team comes out big the next game. It's like it never happened, and then it doesn't carry over to the next game. For anybody that was looking for that Game 7 record for Henrik Lundqvist to continue to carry over there and the success at the Garden, ultimately, I think that was just one more example, was it not, of whatever happened in the previous game really doesn't matter.
Well, I have to say, and again, diehard Ranger fan, lifelong Ranger fan, you know, hoping beyond hope they would win, but with all the hype, and look, Lundqvist is a great goalie. If he never gets a cup in New York, some people have analogized him to Patrick Ewing in New York. I don't quite go there. I mean, I think
right.
Ewing was a great player. Others don't. But I think Lundqvist is a great, great goaltender, certainly arguably the best goaltender in the world in the last 5 years. Having said that, the Rangers simply couldn't score. And I think the story in New York, and you know what the stats were because they were all over the country, Lundqvist can't be beat in Game 7. The Rangers can't get beat in elimination games. They never lost at home in Game 7. But the counter to that, which you didn't hear in New York much, was Bishop on the road for some reason. Ben Bishop, the 6'7" Lightning goalie, I don't understand this, but for some reason, and the conference finals were a perfect example, he gave up 2 goals in Game 1 at the Madison Square Garden. He gave up 2 goals in Game 2 at Madison Square Garden. Got the 1-1 split you're looking for if you're Tampa Bay. Came back in Game 5 and shut out the Rangers. Came back in Game 7 in Madison Square Garden and shut out the Rangers. So his road record, I mean, I don't even know how to explain this. He gave up 4 goals in 4 games in Madison Square Garden on the road. He gave up 15 goals in 3 games in Tampa. So, to me, that's inexplicable, except you had already seen the pattern the first 6 games. So, yes, the Rangers had 27 things on their side historically, which, as we know, when you drop the puck means nothing. But Bishop also had, and he said afterwards in the interview was interesting. He said, you know, they pulled him in Game 6. after he'd given up five goals to the Rangers. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man, this guy's crushed. He's devastated. What we spoke about before, does it linger from Game 6 to Game 7? Obviously it didn't, and Bishop after Game 7 said, look, I've played really well here. We've beaten them a lot in this building. This is not a surprise to us. And I thought I saw almost a defeatist look in Lundqvist's face after he gave up the first soft goal between the legs. And then, frankly, after the game, look, I love Lundqvist. He's great. But after the game, he said, you know, when they scored the second goal, I thought it took the life out of the building. I thought it took the life out of our team. But I think what he was really saying, Rick, was, my goodness, we can't score. And down two goals in the third period of a Stanley Cup Game 7 for the New York Rangers, who can't score, is like being down five or six goals. I think he's thinking now, am I ever going to get over the hump? Because I can play great, but my team can't score. And that's what happened to them again this year.
Well, and that's one of the things I wonder about from afar with the Rangers as I look at them, because, again, you look back at the last couple of years, and scoring punch, elite scoring punch, isn't necessarily the end-all, be-all. You look at Boston with one conference championship and one Stanley Cup win to show for it in the last couple of years, but it seems like the Rangers are trying to do it somewhat the same kind of way without necessarily as dominant of a defense, although it is a very good defense, and Lundqvist between the pipes, I agree with you. I'd say he's the best goalie probably over the last 10 years or so at this point. But are they trying to do it with a formula that's kind of blowing into the wind a little bit? Because you look at a team with the punch at Tampa Bay, a team like Chicago, a team like L.A., when they've won the cup the last couple of times out there, and it generally is teams that have a little bit more really elite end scoring than what the Rangers are trying to do it with.
Well, I think the problem for the Rangers was, and look, it happened last year as well, I think Rick Nash is a great hockey player, and I don't think he has to be a goal scorer to play great. And I thought he played great when he was getting hammered this year and last year in New York for lack of scoring. Having said that, he's your 42-goal scorer this year. And if he's a 42-goal scorer who can't score in the playoffs, that's a problem. But he's not Ovechkin. He's not a super shooter. He's a grinder. He's an around-the-net guy. And maybe they just pay more attention to him in the playoffs. He certainly had lots of shots. He had lots of opportunity. He scored a few goals, but not many. And I think that's one of the problems. The other thing is, much as I liked the St. Louis deal last year and wrote when it happened that it was a win-now deal for last year, and they did make it to the finals last year and nobody thought they would, this year, he was, you know, just invisible in the playoffs. And I doubt the Rangers are going to bring him back. He's going to be 40. But Martin St. Louis, who's probably a Hall of Famer and, of course, was in Tampa forever, you know, he couldn't score at all. They lost Zuccarello, a key loss. I'm not saying they lost the series because they lost Zuccarello. But he's one of those gritty guys around the net, can score a little, can take a beating. You know, it turns out, Rick, he had a skull fracture when he got hit in the head with that puck. He got a skull fracture. He didn't just have a concussion. Apparently couldn't speak for 4 days. Nobody knew about this till, you know, a day or two ago. And that was a big loss. I'm not going to say it was a deciding loss, but he's one of those guys you need, a Stephane Matteau, if you want to go back to the 94 Rangers. He's one of those guys you need in order to win a cup. So I thought that was a big blow. But I got to tell you, looking at next year, and you're right about the offense, Tampa Bay, for example, 259 goals in the regular season. They led the league in scoring goals, and at the end of the day, as great as Lundqvist is, you get down 2-0, as he said. It sucked the life out of the building. I think it hurt him mentally as well, and it's kind of the analogy I used is to the pitcher who goes out there for a bad team, a low-scoring offensive baseball team, and he's down 1-2-0 in the third, fourth inning. He's like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, then you try and make pitches a little finer, and then you make mistakes. So, too, I think it is with goaltenders mentally when your team doesn't score. And at the end of the day, the Rangers lost because they couldn't score.
Exactly. And the drop-off from Nash to some of the other guys, I think, it's a little bit steeper once you start going down that path than it is for Tampa to their second guy, their third guy, et cetera. And excellent baseball analogy. I would also throw in their football. It puts me in mind of teams that when they fall behind, there's nothing that can be done about it. I remember back to the NFC Championship game well over a decade ago with the Eagles and the Panthers. And the Panthers got up to that lead, and like the game was basically over. They were up 10 points, and there wasn't any sense the Eagles could do anything about it. So, yeah, it's always really kind of interesting whenever a team that's built to have the lead really kind of jostles like a fish out of water when they don't have the lead and are struggling to get back in it. As far as it goes for the finals this year, I want to start big picture. I want to start with the fact that Chicago is, in just about all quarters right now, the favorite. I've seen most of the pundits taking them. I see that they are the Vegas favorite. And there are very good reasons for that. You look at the experience, you look at the championship pedigree. I want to ask you if you think that that really kind of plausibly outweighs three factors that I'm going to throw at you. First factor is, again, this is a team that's played into June a lot the last couple of years. Last year was only June 1, but still played into June. So you have that toll that they are carrying. You have the toll that they're carrying of having played Anaheim with the physicality of it. Ryan Kesler with that famous quote during the series about a team is not built to withstand beatings like this and what Anaheim did to them with all of the hitting. Additionally, this didn't really come into play as much until the conference finals because Chicago drew Minnesota and Nashville first. There wasn't as much travel there. But the cross-country flights, Chicago-Anaheim in a 2-2-1-1-1 series, much less a series with the two deep overtime games. Chicago, it seems to me, comes in with a lot more of a potential hangover effect than does Tampa. Do you think that all of that could possibly outweigh the experience?
Well, I picked Chicago early before the playoffs, and now do I think they could be factors? Absolutely. Having said that, you know, in 2015, Chicago to California, these guys fly charter. You know, I don't think that's a big deal. I do think, you know, playing into June every year, I think today, nutrition-wise, you know, this isn't the 60s and 70s when guys show up to training camp fat and out of shape. Everybody seems to work out virtually 11, if not 12 months a year. I think they're all possibilities, and maybe people will point to that if Tampa Bay wins, but I give you a guy like Kane. You know, the big thing, if you follow the Blackhawks, and I do, I'm a Ranger fan, but I follow the Blackhawks as well. You know, Kane missed, I think, 2.5 months this year. That's probably a plus as we go into the season. I thought it was a huge plus for the Rangers that Lundqvist missed a lot of time. Talbot showed he could play. But more importantly to me, Lundqvist, who never seems to be rested for the playoffs, was fully rested now. But that's just another question mark in the Rangers' mind. I don't want to go there. But with Patrick Kane missing a lot of time, I would say he's got fresh legs for the playoffs. And, you know, Toews has been around for so long. He's a super-duper star. Huss is an old vet. I think these guys all know how to take care of themselves. The interesting thing to me is nobody's going to say that Corey Crawford, cup-winning goalie in 2013, is one of the top goalies in the league. If we're going to look strictly at goalies, this is not a goalie series. I certainly thought that the Canadiens really had a big chance to win against Tampa Bay simply because of Carey Price versus Bishop. Now, again, Bishop, to me now, it's almost a negative for Tampa Bay that they have they're the higher seed. They have home ice advantage, at least against the Rangers, and I think for most of the playoffs, frankly. If you look at home versus road for Bishop, for some reason he's better on the road. That does not bode well for Tampa Bay. Normally you want that seventh game at home, but if you showed up in the Rangers versus Tampa Bay and Bishop had given up 15 goals in three games in Tampa and 4 goals in three games at the Garden for Game 7, you're a Tampa fan. Where'd you want Game 7 to be? You wanted it to be in Madison Square Garden, I think. I thought it was an advantage. I thought the Rangers had everything in their corner, but of course they didn't, and they got shut out. By the way, Bishop is the first goalie ever, I think, to shut out a road shutout to win Game 7 in the conference final. He's the first goalie ever to do that. In fact, he's the first goalie to have shutouts in Game 5 and Game 7 on the road. Shows you how hard it is. I still can't explain these things. I still don't know why it worked out the way it did, but I think it's a disadvantage for Tampa Bay to have home ice in this final series. So, yeah, your points are well taken, Rick. I think Chicago has the experience and the cup winners and the big-time scorers / players to get over the hump just as they did against Anaheim, although no doubt Anaheim, a physical team, took a lot out of them.
Exactly. Home ice disadvantage, as it were, for Tampa as it relates to Bishop, who, again, probably has more high points to nod at during the course of the playoffs than Corey Crawford, the decorated goalie that he's going up against, at least decorated if you want to point to his record as opposed to him being a statistical marvel, which he has not been through the course of his career. One of the things I want to get to here in terms of the ebbs and flows of a series is that a guy that we really haven't talked much about yet, probably the most skilled player in the series, I think few would probably disagree with this, Steven Stamkos making his Stanley Cup final debut for Tampa Bay, a young man really just starting to get to his prime, which is amazing because of what he's done thus far through the course of his career. This is something that kind of galls me in terms of some of the commentary that we saw coming out of the Detroit series. There was the sense among a lot of people out there, a lot of big-name pundits, that Tampa Bay was a team that was ripe to be plucked because, OMG, Stamkos isn't doing anything. Now, if you think he's hurt, that's one thing. But this is just a sense of people thinking that Tampa Bay was in trouble because Stamkos wasn't on track. And to me, it's akin to, as a Cavs fan, watching LeBron go 0-10, 0-11, during the first half of the game against the Hawks. I was talking to my friend at halftime, and I said, you know, the Hawks are going to cry that they lost the game because of Horford. No, they didn't lose the game because of the ejection. They're going to lose the game because of LeBron shooting like Chris Dudley for one half, and they're up 1 point. I mean, I would be terrified to play Tampa Bay unless I thought Stamkos was hurt. But if he had done nothing, and they managed to get through a series anyways, it seems that it's not really commonly understood out there how regression to the mean can kind of play in through the course of a postseason, over the course of a season as a whole. But essentially, everything really kind of does bounce back to zero, doesn't it, Steve? Ultimately, things should come out somewhere close to where you expect them to be. And if you haven't gotten much production yet from Stamkos, then I think what he's done over the last two rounds really shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that knows hockey.
Well, no question, but I think the story for Tampa Bay, Stamkos, 4 goals, 3 assists against the Rangers, you know, certainly did his share of scoring in that series, but you're right, he had been criticized previously. But I think these playoffs, and if they do win the Cup, I think it's more about the triplets, Johnson, Kucherov, Palat. I mean, they combined for 11 goals against the Rangers in the 7 games, and they scored, the entire team scored 21. So they had 11, Stamkos had 4. That's 15, you know, that's 75% of the goal score. So Stamkos is a superstar, there's no doubt about it. The problem in hockey for me is it's not like basketball. You know, if a guy's averaging 22 a game and he gets 17 or 18, he didn't get his average, but he got 17 or 18. If you're a goal scorer, and I don't even know, maybe today in today's baseball you can analogize it to home run hitters. But if you're a goal scorer, you can go 5 games without scoring a goal. You can go 8 games without scoring a goal. It's not like you can score 15 points a game and be a little subpar. You either score or you don't. And in basketball, the beauty of basketball, if you like that game, is it's a stat stuffer's dream. You know, you can go 18-10 and 5 assists. Oh, and you're fantastic. But in hockey, it's pretty much just goals. Obviously, assists are important as well. So, yeah, I thought Stamkos took an unfair beating. But I do think the story, and certainly the reason that Tampa Bay beat the Rangers, were Tyler Johnson leading all scorers in the playoffs. But Kucherov, Palat, I mean, these guys are stars. And if you didn't know it before, now the triplets were talked about all season. This is not something that just they woke up against the Rangers. They've been good all season. But I think it's just like in the old days of the Celtics when they had the big three plus Rajon Rondo. When they won that title, I thought it was Rondo and the big three. Well, it used to be Stamkos and who else was coming. Now the triplets are the big three to me, and Stamkos is also a huge factor, obviously, in their success. But as you said, comparing to the Rangers, a huge drop-off after Nash. But these guys have 4 or 5. Tampa has 4 or 5 guys who can beat you, and that's exactly what happened to the Rangers because they had 4 guys with 4 goals and another guy with 3 goals. And that in a 7-game series against one team, that's gonna you know, kill you. They were coming from everywhere.
Exactly. And when you're looking at what they have to offer as well, it also goes to the blue line. You've also got Victor Hedman there, which is very interesting to me because that ties to a bigger point that I have seen some people making recently here, vis-a-vis the notion of Chicago sort of being where Tampa Bay wants to be in a couple of years, or if you look at it the other way around, that this Tampa team is like Chicago from about 3, 4, 5 years ago at that stage of development. It really does look like a mirror with some of the talent that each of the teams have, and it really right down to the goalies who are rarely, if ever, the cause of them winning a game. Now, again, Bishop has had his high points during the series here, but Crawford has sort of been, if you will, and for as much as I love Chris Osgood, really sort of akin to what he did with the Red Wings. Just don't lose it for us. You really think both of those goalies, I think, are more so like that than Henrik Lundqvist kinds who consistently elevate a team. Is it a little bit simplistic to say that, that Tampa really is sort of a younger version sort of Chicago at this point?
No, I actually kind of like that because if you go back to 2010 and look at these young guys who were coming up at the time, Taze, Kane, those kinds of guys, I think that's a very good analogy. I think Crawford is kind of, I don't want to say he's Trent Dilfer, but, you know, he was replaced in the playoffs. In these playoffs against Nashville, Scott Darling came in, started a few games, played well, and then Crawford got the job back. So I think to some degree, you know, I always wonder, is Lundqvist at home thinking, man, why can't I be in the Blackhawks? Why can't I be in Tampa Bay? I could give up four goals and win once in a while. And you really have to wonder because this is the theme certainly in these finals. I don't think it's going to be about the goalies. If one of these goalies stands on his head, and that can happen, but we always talk about the best goalies getting to the finals. Obviously not the case, and that's to take nothing away from Bishop. He was unconscious in the Garden against the Rangers, nor against Crawford. He did win a cup, whatever you want to say about him. He won a cup in 2013. I don't think it's you don't lose the cup if you're the goalie. You know what I mean? This is like a goalie still has to make saves, et cetera, and he certainly had his moments. But interesting to me, and I remember reading some articles in the Chicago papers that they didn't think they could go back to Crawford after Darling came in and played great against Nashville early on. But here we are now, and Darling's an afterthought, and Crawford's getting the start. I did want to mention one other thing that hurts me. Martin St. Louis, you probably know, the Rangers traded their captain, Ryan Callahan, one of the most respected guys in New York and in the league, to get St. Louis. And again, I wrote at the time, you know, this is a win now thing. Callahan's an excellent player. He's going to, you know, got 10 good years in front of him, plus he was the captain. So when you go down the Tampa Bay roster, you not only see the former captain, Callahan, Anton Stroman was a very good defenseman for the Rangers. He's there. I think they're getting the last laugh. Brian Boyle, another 6'7 guy. I mean, they've got some gigantic defensemen between Hedman and Boyle, another ex-Ranger from last year. And it was very interesting, again, in New York, why didn't you keep Brian Boyle? He plays so well in the playoffs. And they said, apparently officially said, he was so bad in the regular season we couldn't afford to keep him. That makes no sense to me, Rick. If you got a guy who's bad in the regular season and excellent in the playoffs, you find a way to just get him through the regular season, even if he's your sixth or seventh defenseman. But they let him go, and obviously, as we see the seven Knicks who are laughing all the way through the NBA playoffs, J.R. Smith is getting the first, second, and last laugh, not to jump sports, but it's similar here. You got to think Callahan, Strowman, and Brian Boyle are sitting in the locker room going, man, we made the right decision, because Tampa's the team on the rise, and I'm not going to say the Rangers are going down, but the Rangers are leveling off, and their window's going to close long before Tampa Bay's window closes. And I'm not saying it's closed. I think the Rangers can be right there next year, but as you've said throughout this thing, without scoring, it's going to be hard for them to get over the hump next year as well.
Well, and in terms of scoring for Tampa Bay and the Rangers, there's another ghost involved in this as well, suiting up for Chicago, that being Brad Richards, somebody who was a letdown, quite frankly, during his time in New York, and somebody who was the Conn Smythe winner, the only other time that Tampa Bay hoisted the cup in 2004 when they won the Stanley Cup. So, yeah, he's been rejuvenated in Chicago, a late career boost. He'll be going against his old team. In terms of coming full circle here and looking at predictions, as I have indicated, I'm not going to deviate from any of my predictions at this point here. I got a chance to go 14-1 if it all breaks my way. I'm going to say Tampa in six, and I'll say Tyler Johnson for Conn Smythe just because, again, he's got to be probably the favorite coming into this series with everything that he's done thus far. I will freely confess, if it goes that way, I will be happy. Steve Yzerman's my all-time favorite athlete, so Tampa Bay, hence, is my second favorite NHL team. And as a good Red Wings fan, I have no love for the Blackhawks. Having said that, I did say Warriors in seven, reluctantly, in the NBA Finals. So this is not just me being biased here. But that's my objective pick, Tampa Bay in six. I know you disagree. What's your sense of how long it might go, Steve?
Yeah, I'm going to go Chicago in five because I think Chicago is going to take a 2-0 lead and beat Tampa in Tampa. I don't know if this, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know if this can't play at home, give up. If you gave up 15 goals in three games at home in Tampa to the Rangers, I don't want to say he's going to give up 20 to Chicago, but if he gives up 15 to Chicago, they're going to lose those games. So I don't know if it's a road-home thing. I don't know if there's something you can do. It makes no sense. I haven't read any analysis of it. In fact, I've hardly read anything about how great Bishop was on the road, which is absurd. 4 goals in 4 games in Madison Square Garden. So I'm going to say Chicago in five, and I'm going to go with Toews, of course, who had 2 goals in Game 7 against Anaheim because he's Toews. I mean, he's one of the 5 best players in the world. And so I'll go Chicago in 5. And since I'm not from Cleveland, I'm going to go Cavaliers in 6 against Golden State because at the end of the day, they have some guys, including the King, who has championship experience, and as good as Golden State is, they have nobody who has that experience, and I think at some point that has to come out. I remember in the first time that Miami made the finals, Miami against Dallas, Miami was up 1-0, and I went on a radio station in New York and said, I still like Dallas. They have the superstars. They have the experience. And Miami, who was 9-8 that first year, you'll recall, just as the Cavs were not good at the beginning of this year, they couldn't get over the hump against Dallas, which was surprising. So I think there's something to that championship experience, both in the NHL, Blackhawks in 5, and both in the and in the NBA. So I'll go Cavaliers because I think you're secretly rooting for them, Rick.
yeah, not so secretly. I'll be in the plaza probably for Game 6 watching it on the screen outside if it goes down that way, and I will be part of the entire city burning down, I would say, after 51 years. I can't even imagine what it's going to be like trying to get home that night if it goes that way. I certainly hope it does. So we have that to look forward to, of course, with the NBA Finals and with what we've been talking about today with the Stanley Cup Finals. But that brings us to... Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini-episode number 569. Rick Morris and Steve Callis, your FDH Lounge dignitaries today. Steve Callis, good friend from the STN.net, from WFAN in New York, stevecallis.com. Steve, of course, one of our premier in-house guys, just about top of the list here for talking horse racing. I think we've done this with him and with Bob Glassman previously, but... few, if any, people I know are any smarter than Steve about horse racing. And, again, with the Triple Crown on the line this weekend at Belmont, American Pharoah, with a chance to bring it home in a field that now has been shrunk to 8 horses. And we're doing this a little bit of a disadvantage here. We're doing this before the post draw, so we don't know where everybody's going to be staffed as we are recording this today. But thoughts going into this weekend about the shorter field, and similar actually to what we saw at the Preakness, even though the length will be exactly opposite of what we saw there.
Yeah, well, a very interesting race. You know, it's just hard to believe that a horse can race the way American Pharoah has raced. And again, as you know, that's 3 times in 5 weeks, 3 different racetracks, 3 different distances. He also raced 3 weeks before the Derby when he won the Arkansas Derby. So this is really 4 races in 8 weeks. I got to tell you, these horses are not bred that way anymore. They're not trained that way anymore. Can American Pharoah do it? Well, you know, a lot of people thought he didn't have the pedigree to go 1.25 miles in the Derby. Obviously, he can do that. I thought he got a huge break in the Preakness because he's excellent in the slop, and there was a monsoon 15 minutes before the Preakness. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So do I think he can win? Yes. Will I pick him at the end of this segment to win? No. There's just something about picking against these horses. He certainly is a talented horse who has already outraced his pedigree. It's interesting. I'm certainly not a pedigree expert, but I do follow it. And things like dosage index, where American Pharoah has the highest dosage index in the field, the lower the dosage index, at least in theory, the better chance you can go 12 furlongs, 1.5 miles, which is what the Belmont is. Again, these horses have never gone this distance before, and they will never go this distance again. So there's a lot to what's happened in recent years. As you know, people race in the Derby. They take off the Preakness, so they have a month off between the Derby and the Belmont, and invariably those fresh shooters coming out of the woodwork invariably beat the almost Triple Crown winner. And again, we've had a number of them over the years. They just can't seem to get the job done. So I won't be shocked if he wins. He'll be hailed as a super horse, as he should be, but I don't think he's going to win the Belmont.
Well, in terms of pedigree, I want to ask you a question about that, although I got a side note just to put out there previously. I don't remember where I had read this exactly, but somebody making the quasi-farcical note that horses that have had the chance to win the Triple Crown the last few times out have typically had names like Smarty Jones. And if you look at the very, very regal list of names of Triple Crown winners, American Pharoah fits on that list nicely. Most of the other ones that were also rans in recent years do not. That's not anything that's hard science. Something that is hard science that I want to ask you about, and again, I'm not a guy who knows a tremendous amount about horse racing, although I've been going to the track on and off a good part of my life and have read about it a decent degree. And when I read about it, it's mostly from this guy. I've got a book or two from him, Andrew Beyer. He had a column in the Washington Post that I put aside that I wanted to ask you about because I've not seen this come up anywhere. I'm sure this is something that's old hat to somebody like you. I'm sure you've thought about this point previously, but he's talking about the role of breeding and pedigree and that horses are pretty much these days obviously bred for speed. You're talking about, well, they haven't run this distance before. They'll never run it again. Because the Belmont is such an anomaly, I want to get your thoughts on his column about how the breeding of these horses puts some of the elite ones at a real disadvantage because the elite horses in recent decades have not really been bred for stamina.
Yeah, I read the column, and of course, Barr is one of the premier writers, semi-retired now from the Washington Post, but still contributes and to the Daily Racing Forum. You know, the Barr speed figures is still the key to these kinds of races, or many people rely on them. And of course, I think he's right. But the problem is now, it's true in thoroughbred racing, it's true in harness racing where I worked at the track there for 10 years, you breed for speed. You don't breed for stamina. You don't breed for distance. You don't race for distance. You know, a mile and a quarter is considered incredibly long. So a mile and a half is, you know, ridiculous. We will talk about one horse, Mooptahege, who's Irish bred, and some people are picking him as a hot horse because he is bred for distance. They breed differently in Ireland than they do in the U.S. But for many years now, the breeders in America breed for speed, and that's true in both of those sports, and you don't go there looking for horses who can grind it out for a mile and a half. You look for horses who can get there quickly, and that's why there's been a movement towards, in the last, I'll say, 25 years, a movement towards sprinters and speed horses, milers, if you will, but certainly no more than a mile and a quarter. And even those races aren't as often as they used to be. So you have the classic distance of the Derby, a mile and a quarter, but nobody ever goes more than that except in the Belmont. And really, your top races, the Met Mile, for example, a lot of these races are at 1 mile. So that's the new distance. And again, it's not new anymore. It's been going on for at least 25 years. A mile and an eighth, a mile and a quarter. So part of the reason, and certainly I'm in the camp that thinks they should spread these races out. I know a lot of people aren't. But part of the reason is simply because there's no reason. What Beyer said essentially was there's no reason to breed for distance because you're only talking about the Belmont, and as you said, it's an anomaly. And we're all for tradition, we're all for this, we're all for that, but these horses have not been bred to race 3 times in 5 weeks. You go back in the old days of these other Triple Crown winners in the 30s and 40s, I mean, they routinely raced every other week. That's not true anymore. If you have a thoroughbred who races more than once a month now, that's unusual, and I'm not talking about cheap claimers who might race every few weeks. If you have a good horse, you're not racing them more than once a month, and I've written columns in the past, Kentucky Derby first Saturday in May, Preakness first Saturday in June, Belmont first Saturday in July, and then they can all show up if they want at the Travers at Saratoga at the end of August after getting 7 weeks off and go fight some more, and that leads you to the Breeders' Cup. So I think it should be changed. I understand the reasons not to change, but the notion, the analogy I use, and you'll like it, Rick, it's a baseball analogy. The analogy I use is if we thought like these people, Major League pitchers would be pitching either every third day or every fourth day.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if you look at the history of baseball, and I have, and I've written these articles as well, when Cy Young pitched, why do these guys have 380, 400, 511 wins like Cy Young. They pitched every third day. And then in the 20s, it started to be every fourth day. And then in the late 60s, I remember interviewing Jim Cott some years ago. He said the first team to go to a four-man rotation with the Mets in the late 60s to protect Seaver and Kuzmin and Gentry and even a young Nolan Ryan. They were the first. And then through the 70s, everybody went. And so now we have, you know, you pitch every fifth day. And I wrote an article last year that the Mets should go to a six-man rotation. So if we use the same analogy in horse racing, if we use it in baseball, you'd have guys pitching every third or fourth day. Who would listen to that for human beings? So why is it different for horses? I've never understood that, nor do I get an answer. Other is, oh, it's tradition, and that's why we've always done it that way. I really think it's a mistake.
I think that's a perfect point of comparison. I really, really do, because the parallels in terms of the evolution in the two sports are really so clear. You can't escape it if you really look at it with an open mind. With the other horses in the field with a chance to win, ultimately in our remaining couple minutes, I'm going to put it out there. I will take Pharaoh to get off to a good, strong lead and just barely hang on at the end. I will say American Pharaoh, Frosted to place, Materiality to show. What say you, Steve, as far as the overall field here, who can get it done, who you think will?
There's only eight in here. I think a few of them can get it done, but I'm certainly going to pick as my winner. I'm going to go with Frosted. I think he had a horrific trip in the Derby. He was wide on both turns. He was the only one going forward in the stretch. He was the one who came out of the pack to be fourth, beaten only 3 1/4 lengths. He rallied from 15th. He was excellent in the Wood Memorial. An angle I like a lot that seems to have gotten out of favor in the last few years is he raced at Belmont as a two-year-old. It was admittedly his second lifetime start, but he has raced over the track. You know, Belmont's a mile and a half with those huge sweeping turns. They call it the Big Sandy for a reason. The track is a little different. American Pharaoh, I know, trained at Churchill Downs and came up to New York today, so he might just go around the track slowly a couple of times, you know, in the next few days, but he's not even going to train on it, never mind race on it. That doesn't mean he can't win, but generally speaking, I like horses who have a start over the track, even if it was a year ago. Kieran McLaughlin, an excellent trainer. You know, in 2006, he finished fourth in the Derby with Jazeel, skipped the Preakness, won the Belmont. I don't know, maybe it's just a fluke thing that he finished fourth in the Derby and Frosted finished fourth in the Derby, but I kind of like them. I also look back at Frosted's prior races. He was very poor in the Fountain of Youth, and they scoped him after the race. They put something down his throat to look what was down there, and they wound up doing a minor throat procedure on him after the Fountain of Youth. So his two races since they did that minor throat procedure, he won the Wood by 2 lengths back in April. He ran a big race in the Derby, in my opinion. You know, you can go watch that. His jockey is Joel Rosario, who you will remember last year, Rick. We spoke a lot about him. Why? Because when we did the Belmont show with Jody McDonald last year, we both liked Tonalist to win, and one of the reasons was Joel Rosario. Joel Rosario has ridden Frosted the last two times. The Wood Memorial victory was the first time he rode him, and now the Derby. He obviously knows the horse. My only complaint would be, and this is a good thing for him now that there's only eight horses in the race, in those other races he came from pretty far back to win, and you generally, even though the Belmont's a mile and a half and people talk about closers, you don't really come from way back, but in an eight-horse field, if he moves him up just a little early in the race, we don't know what post position he has as we're talking right now, but if he can stay close to the leaders in an eight-horse race, that shouldn't be hard. I think his kick at the end is going to have him go by an American Pharaoh, especially if a horse like Materiality, who's another horse a lot of people like. Materiality, Todd Pletcher's horse, was 3 for 3 before the Derby. I thought he had a pretty clean trip in the Derby, but he had a terrible break. He usually likes to go for the lead. I think he's going to go for the lead in the Belmont, and that might put some pressure on American Pharaoh. If American Pharaoh gets loose on the lead, horses do win the Belmont on the lead, even though it is a mile and a half. And the only caveat to all of this that I would say is if it rains, if there's a monsoon 15 minutes before the Belmont, American Pharaoh really picks up because he loves the slop. I'll just mention briefly a few of the other horses because they do deserve to be mentioned. And there's only, you know, eight in the field. But a hot horse now, if you will, is this Moob Tahij, who's Irish bred. And, you know, I read something about his breeding, and he's bred to go forever, and people are saying, oh, he can go a mile and a half, no problem. And all of that is true, Rick, But again, watch the Derby. It was his first start in America. Normally the horses that come from, Dubai don't do well. He made kind of a move towards the top of the stretch, and then he just flattened out and even went backwards. So if that happened at a mile and a quarter, no matter how he's bred, I don't see how he's going to be great at a mile and a half. But he's kind of a hot horse, if you will. A couple of other horses.
I would agree with that, Steve. And we're about to get cut off here, but I want to thank you so much for being a part of the show here today. Great stuff breaking it all down. Thank you, as always, Steve. Thank you all, everybody, for tuning in to this mini episode of the FDH Lounge.